You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
So at the very least, as citizens, voting, informing yourself to be an informed citizen when you walk into that, to cast that ballot, and raising good citizens, raising children to be good citizens.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Mr. Jack Carr, former Navy SEAL, author, executive producer, actor, so on, right? You got a lot of stuff going on now.
A lot of stuff going on. Yeah, the actor thing, you know, I didn't have to do too much. Didn't have to, it wasn't a big stretch to play a former operator slash assassin contractor type guy and getting a shoot out with Chris Pratt. But I did have to tell him that if this was real life, it would have gone down a little bit differently. Just had to make sure keep him, just got to keep him humble.
Yeah, you can't let Chris get one up on you like that, for sure.
No. It was pretty cool to see it. They mentioned it was cool to see how they do that in Hollywood, how they put bullet holes in glass.
Oh, yeah.
And what they do is they little like metal straws that are like mortar tubes, and they're just below the dash in a car. And so they're just lined up right there. And then you're behind the wheel and Chris is shooting in. But what makes it look like there's bullet holes in the glass is the guy on the side, and he's pushing these buttons, and a little charge is going off in the bottom of these metal straws, sending a small ball bearing up into the glass. So I have sunglasses on so the glass doesn't go into my eyes, but it looks like there's little bullets coming through the glass. So it's kind of cool to have those things going off and getting the shootout and do the thing.
You know, one of these days you're going to have to do maybe on Danger Closer, maybe just do it as like a mini doc and explain how all the Hollywood magic happened, because people are super interested in that stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, of course, there's not a lot of green screen stuff in Terminal S, but like background. And now I notice it in movies. Like, you're like, how did they do that? How did they make the mountains in the background like that? You know, from the 1800s, aren't there houses there? And, you know, the digital effects is amazing, but still the stuntmen, I mean, they wouldn't let me do the stunt, the car crash. And I thought, I can, you know, get in a little car crash, no big deal. And then I saw it and I was like, oh, I'm kind of glad I didn't do that at this stage with the little neck. I had some neck surgery, spine surgery a few years ago. Right. And glad they didn't let me do it, because it actually looked in person a lot harder than it looks on screen. But the guy who doubled me was Mick Rogers, who's a famous Hollywood stuntman. And he doubled Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon, jumping off that building handcuffed to Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
So it was really cool to meet him and get to talk to him about that. Because obviously Lethal Weapon is a very formative film for those of us who grew up in the 80s.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Hollywood magic stuff is pretty fun.
Well, I mean, that must be quite the treat for you, because you're kind of a nerd in those regards. Like, you geek out on that stuff and now you've got inside access to it. Does it, I'm sure sometimes you just got to sit on your hands and keep your mouth shut because we got work to do. But when you got a little free time, it's like, hey, tell me some stuff, because I really want to know.
There's some, and you hear the old Hollywood stories too. So you hear from guys on the set that have worked on films in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and the differences in the evolution of the industry. And it's really cool to hear those stories as well, or interactions with stars that we all know on different sets, and you get kind of insight into that, and then the business side of it. So there's a lot to it. But what it has done is also made me realize just how many places a film can totally go off the rails.
Yeah.
And makes me appreciate films that actually get made. It makes me a lot more understanding. And I was always understanding before, trying to enjoy, you know, movies for what they are, rather than trying to pick out all the little things that are wrong. But but now I just see how many people are involved. Like a book like this, like that's one person. If it's something's wrong, that's all on me. But over there in Hollywood, there are 350 people on set.
Yeah.
There are multiple writers in a writer's room. There, then there's editing, where someone can take a shot that just looks better because of the lighting, but has no idea that, let's say, the scope cover's on, or that the actor's finger's on the trigger when he's pointing at his buddy's head, or something like that. So there are just so many opportunities for these things to completely go off the rails. So I'm much more understanding now, having been a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that goes into that stuff, and there are so many people that are involved that have no idea, you know, about some of the particulars. So, one of the things about that people, we get this feedback a lot whenever we have you on, and I share this sentiment, is that just the attention to detail in your writing is something that really draws me to your books. Like, Hurwitz books are like that too. Like, there's super attention to detail. I'm a big fan of that stuff. So it's nice to see it come across on screen, because, you know, I would say even today, the shows and TV and films that get it right are probably in the minority, like get it like really right. You know what I mean? Like SEAL Team does a pretty good job, but half the fucking crew over there are SEALs or tier one operators, right? So that's always a nice benefit. But yeah, on a big movie project like that, you can't always, you know, have that many actual gunfighters on the job. So, but let's get back to, I want to start a little bit earlier here. It's kind of a trope these days with the GWAT that somebody joined the military because of 9/11. You were in before that, but your story is a little bit different, because a lot of my buddies that join, especially the Navy and especially the SEALs, it had something to do with some of the operations they may have seen or heard about in the news, or Charlie Sheen obviously was a great recruiter for the Navy. But for you, it's like your entire family served in the military. So you were thinking about this from a very young age. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, very early. I think it was just in my blood. I think even if my grandfather hadn't served in World War II, even if I hadn't had his medals, hadn't had the silk maps that they gave aviators back then, because if you had a paper one and hit the water, it would disintegrate, but a silk map would just get wet. You could still use it. So I had all those. I still have all those. I have his wings. He was a Marine Corps fighter pilot, flew the Corsair. And there was a show on TV called Black Sheep Squadron back then, for those who remember, with Robert Conrad playing Pappy Boynton. So really before the age of social media, that was my connection and my dad's connection to that generation, because you couldn't just look on Facebook and try to find someone who knew your dad. My grandfather was killed in World War II, so my dad never had any connection to him other than through the medium of popular culture, in particular that show. Once again, there wasn't a Facebook group where you could go and find that squadron and say, you know, track somebody down when you were age 9, 10, 11, 12 and say, hey, tell me about my dad. That just didn't exist unless someone wrote a letter to you specifically, which is one of the reasons that in 2000, one of my best friends burned in parachuting. And so I wrote a letter to his son, who was just 1 year old at the time. So about the same age my dad was when his father died. So I wanted him to have a letter written by me in 2000 with memories that were current.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I did that because my dad didn't have those types of letters. So so even without all that, I think I would have, it was just in my blood to serve and to want to test myself. And I think it's just a part of you. And it's been a part of most people from the beginning of time. You had to be a good fighter. You had to be a good hunter, or else you weren't long for this earth, and neither was your tribe. Mm. So I think it was just in my blood, but found out about SEALs through a movie called, once again, popular culture, through a movie called The Frogman. Mm. And for those who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you'll remember that before remote controls, us kids were the remote controls. And so there was three channels and one outlier. There was ABC, CBS, NBC, and then this one outlier channel that on Sundays was always playing a war movie. So as my dad was watching football, commercial would come up, he'd look at his watch, and I'd run up to the TV and turn it to that outlier channel to watch a war movie for 2 minutes. And then he'd look at his, you know, keep looking at his watch and tell me to turn it back to football, and we'd watch football till the next commercial. But one of those was the Frogmen. And so I asked my dad, hey, who are these guys? I see these guys in an old black and white film. They're coming up out of the water. They're placing explosives on obstacles on beaches. And I asked my dad who they were. And he said, those are Frogmen. And I said, well, what's that? Started pestering him. And he said, ask your mother. So I went to my mom, and she was a librarian, still is, and went down to the local library and started doing some research. And this is early 80s, so there's not much written about special operations back then. Very little written about SEALs. Mm-hmm. But what I found out from that trip was that the training was touted anyway as some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military, and that they were some of the most elite special operators in the world. So from age 7 on, I was on that path. So that was about a decade before Charlie Sheen started his recruitment efforts. And ever since then, the more books started coming out, whether it was by SF guys from Vietnam or SEALs from Vietnam, they slowly started coming out in the later 80s, then early 90s, the late 90s. So I was just always a student of warfare. We had a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas in the house, and I would always go to those, and I'd be always looking up World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, just always looking for anything I possibly could on warfare and specifically special operations. So I was on the path from a very early age. But then at the same time, once again, you get to the end of that library shelf and you've essentially found the end of the internet in 1983, 84, 85, 86. And so I started reading the books my parents were reading in about fifth grade. That's when I switched from young adult literature into the same kind of books my parents were reading. Hunt for Red October comes out then. And then I'm just sixth grade on, I'm on a steady diet of these amazing books by incredible authors. David Morrell, Tom Clancy, Nelson DeMille, A.J. Quinnell, J.C. Pollock, Mark Olden, Louis L'Amour. And I just start going into all these books, loving the magic in those pages. But also because the protagonists back then, and even if you didn't read in the 80s, if you watch movies and TV shows, the protagonists were very similar in that they were all Navy SEALs in Vietnam, Special Army Special Forces, Vietnam, Marine Corps Sniper, Vietnam, CIA Paramilitary, Vietnam. And now in the 80s, they're a private investigator. They're a stuntman. They're a police officer, whatever they might be. But they had that background that would allow them to do the things in the pages of books or on TV or in movies that gave them some credibility. So I loved the magic in those pages and knew that after my time in the military that I would write thrillers.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I wanted to ask you about. It's like your love of writing and commitment to the country and military experience began way before you started writing or before you were in the military. A lot of people have come out of service like that and you know, become good at something, writing or whatever kind of entertainment. But I don't know that I know of anybody else who was already committed to both, right, in the younger years and has kind of progressed through that. So do you think that having that mindset already, being a fan of reading and writing already, do you think it made you pay closer attention to some of the details that you would later articulate onto the page?
I don't know, because I looked at them at the time as two distinct, separate entities and phases of life. I didn't think I would do one in order to make me better at the other. I just came at the writing fan perspective from just reading. And then the military side of the house, just studying warfare, wanting to be the best operator I could possibly be. That's what I thought that I owed the guys, owed my country, owed the mission, owed the families of those that I was taking downrange. So I've never stopped studying warfare. I'm a student, whether it's of warfare, whether it's of writing thrillers, whether it's screenwriting, whatever I'm doing, I always approach it from the perspective of a student. I don't think that'll ever change. It's been a lot of years now, as the white and the beard will tell you.
Yeah.
So I've always approached things like that, and that's just who I am. So I don't think it maybe paid closer attention, but as I'm just always interested in the details. The details matter to me when you're building a foundation on anything. It has to be a solid foundation. No one wants to build. So those details matter, not just in my writing, but in life in general.
So I'd be better to say that the thing that made you good at the one made you good at the other as well, right? That's probably safe to say.
That's exactly it. I didn't realize how personal, like I always knew that as I started to get out, let's say, made the decision to get out after I got back from my last Iraq deployment. So let's say I really made the decision, let's say 2012, somewhere in there. So still had a couple of years left, but at this point I'm not taking guys downrange anymore. I'm the operations officer at BUDS, which is our SEAL training command. And that thing has been around in one way, shape or form essentially since World War II. So that's a nice way of saying you have some time on your hands. Like it's pushups, it's sit-ups, it's runs, it's swims and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the phase instructors each have an officer and a master chief, so they're good to go. So started writing in
let's see, probably December of 2014, I want to say I wrote the first words. And up until that point, I didn't realize, I thought I'd get the details right of sniper weapon systems and whatever else. And if I didn't know something about a helicopter or an aircraft, I could, you know, I knew who to reach out to ask, that sort of thing. But I didn't realize how personal it was going to be until I started writing those first words. And that first few, those first few sentences, it became very obvious that this was going to be a much more personal writing experience than I anticipated at the outset. Meaning I'm going back to memories of Iraq and Afghanistan and remembering what it felt like to be ambushed in Baghdad in 2006, and then taking those feelings and emotions and applying them to a completely fictional narrative. So if my character, Jamie Reese, gets ambushed in Los Angeles, California, as part of this made up story, well, I remember what it felt like to get ambushed in Baghdad, and I can take those feelings and apply them to the story. So even though it's all made up, it's a fictional narrative, the feelings and emotions are real. And I think that stood out to Simon & Schuster when they read it, because they read thousands of these things each year, and to readers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, it definitely rings true. I mean, I think that's probably aside, you're a good writer. The plot's great. Fucking everything's really good about it. But I think the how true it rings is probably what made it as popular as it is amongst actual military veterans. Back to your story, though. You got so you enlisted originally in the Navy, right?
Yep. Part of that, all that research I did growing up pointed me towards the enlisted side of the house for sure. I wanted to be a sniper, and I knew that that officers aren't snipers typically. So so I was on that path, and I wanted to learn the trade and establish a reputation, and then decide if I wanted to be an officer or not. So yeah, I came in enlisted, definitely wanted to be a sniper, went to sniper school in 2000. And so, yeah, it was a good, for me, it was the right path. Not saying it's the right way for everybody to go, but it was the right path for me.
And what made you decide to become an officer? Was that something that the teams approached you about, or was that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, I was approached on that, you know, fairly early on for whatever reasons, but I made that decision before September 11th. So let's say September 11th had happened in January of 2001. I hadn't yet committed to go to OCS. And so I probably would have stayed enlisted at that point, just knowing that you're going to be getting after it on the enlisted side of the house at the tactical level for a lot longer than you will be as an officer. I made the decision before September 11th. So I was already committed. And as it turned out, I got probably as fortunate as one could get as an officer, meaning I went to 3 months of OCS where you do everything you do in boot camp, but you get yelled at by a Marine instead of somebody in the Navy, and you're making your bed, you're folding t-shirts, all those things that make great leaders. And then right back to the SEAL teams. And as soon as I landed, I hadn't been out of the teams for just a couple months, just to go to OCS and fold those t-shirts. Mm-hmm. And so they threw me right into the fight, right into Afghanistan, went down range with one of our top tier units and just to support, and ended up just getting thrown essentially in the train, which was amazing. So I got to learn a lot early on and then take those lessons back to my SEAL team and then go to first Haiti when that kicked off. So that was interesting to go down there with Army, with SF, Charlie 3rd of the 7th down there. I got to be a liaison with them, which meant I just was essentially along for the ride. But it was cool to see the Army start with nothing, essentially just a hangar on an airfield, and how they came in and just built that thing up into a tactical operations center and a huge rock drill area and all the different elements that we're going to need to support units going into Haiti. And that was like, when was that? When Aristide got deposed in 2004, early 2004. And then came back from that and right into Iraq and right into the summer in Najaf and leading a sniper team there and all that stuff. So that's a long way of saying I got very lucky as an officer to be continue operating at the tactical level for a fairly sustained amount of time. So it was a good run.
Yeah, that's why I didn't. I mean, I enlisted for the same reason. I had been to college, but, you know, just a cursory search showed me I was in the 82nd Airborne. So a cursory search showed me I might get some time to fight when I'm a platoon leader as an 01. And then after that, it's unlikely that I'm in the fight again. So it's like, all right, I'm not signing up to do fucking paperwork. No offense to people who do. It's necessary to, we need leaders and stuff, but I wasn't really interested in doing any of that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It's painful. You know, it's good to know your weaknesses, and the admin side of the house was definitely, you know, not my strong suit.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean,
was
it McCarthy who said that wars are won by logistics? I don't remember who it was that said that. It may have been Patton.
Yeah,
said that.
The logistics train. I got to see the Army logistics train is definitely something to see a witness. Whether it's strategic or it's more tactical, meaning when we went into Najaf summer 2004, and I think they gave probably about 2 weeks, let everybody know, hey, get out of here if you're not Jaish al-Mahdi militia. And it ended up being like a two-week campaign, 11 days of which we're engaged in pretty intense urban combat nonstop. But to see how the Army came in there and supplied those troops fighting like us, that water, that food, that ammo, everything moving forward into those front lines, and us pushing forward and bringing that food and that water and that ammo up to us, and just to keep pushing the Jaish al-Mahdi militia toward the Imam Ali Mosque in Old Town Najaf, that Army logistics train's no joke.
Yeah,
they've got that down.
It's pretty good, yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, better. I would say probably the best in the U.S. military. Now, you also were in the Philippines. That's the one area of the GWAT that has no media about it. Nobody ever talks about it. There's been no books, really. I mean, there's been some books, but not any major books. There haven't been any kind of a film or television about it. But it's like the fucking, it's the Wild West down there. I mean, the Philippine government had a weird kind of deal, I guess, off the books deal with those guys, that if they stayed on the southern islands and didn't fuck around on the mainland, they would, you know, turn a blind eye to it. But then things started to escalate. You were down there for some of the hot stuff.
Yeah, it was interesting because obviously I wanted to be in Afghanistan, wanted to be in Iraq, and I ended up going to the Philippines. So what do you got? You have to embrace it. And so I did and started learning. And I got paired up with an Army warrant officer down there on one of the southern islands. I won't say his name, but I'll say his first name, Dave, because he's an awesome dude. But I got to hear all about Army SF warrant officer school. And that seems like an impressive program for those guys. But anyway, he knew a lot about the area because he was coming from first group, and I had been focused on Iraq and Afghanistan and thought I was going to Afghanistan up until essentially the last minute when things changed and we had a commitment that we had to fulfill down in the Philippines. So that's just how it goes sometimes. Yeah. But I started learning, started reading. I went in there to advise a Philippine Marine general. So once again, I took on the role of being a student. And he mentored me, and he'd been fighting down there for his entire career. Mm-hmm. There's been insurgency in the Southern Island chain for they've been fighting it for 100 plus years now. So I got to learn a lot. And it also, it wasn't as dynamic as Iraq and Afghanistan, meaning they would gear up for campaigns in a more traditional way, build up their intel, and then go full force onto one of these islands and essentially eliminate as many terrorists or insurgents or criminal gangs even as they could. So it was a different kind of operating environment. And we were there in support, really utilizing our technical intelligence is the best way to say it, and coupling that with their human. And then, of course, they would go in and do the work, and we could support medically and with a few other things. But man, it was pretty wild down there seeing them go in. And it's hard not to like go in with them. I definitely don't want to give the impression that I was there in the jungle shoulder to shoulder with these Philippine Marines who are going there and getting after it. That is not the case at all. We were back at these FOBs that are located throughout the jungles there. But to see them go in, do that, and then see these guys coming out, just, you know, just bodies lined up of them just getting whacked, getting ambushed, and still being in the fight and us supporting the best way we could, and then carrying those guys to helos and getting them out for the ones that were wounded for medical. It was pretty wild down there. And you're right, not much has been written about it. And I haven't stayed as up to date on it. Maybe I'll do a book down there at some point that talks a little more about it and allows me to get more up to date with what's happened since I was there in 2009. But yeah, it's been a dynamic environment for 100 plus years. So as we both know, it's when you go after an insurgency, it's you can degrade it, dismantle it, but it's more difficult to completely destroy it. So they've been dealing with that for a while.
Yeah, and I think I assume they still are. I mean, I think our major campaign ended in 2017, but I highly doubt that, you know, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, whomever it is, left. Abu Sayyaf is who technically it is, but I mean, it's Wahhabists. I doubt they've left the area, right? There's no way. So I'm sure there's something going on down there. This episode is brought to you by ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Ghostbed. It's the best bed in the world. It's the most comfortable. Sheets, pillows, the whole thing. I've got them all, man. And, you know, they wanted to extend their best possible offer to Drink It Bros. They've been with us for a very long time. So this is the email they sent us. We want Drink It Bros to get the best offer, so I updated the code for 50% site-wide. That's 50% site-wide. Use the code Drinkin' Bros, Drinkin' Bros with no G, for 50% off site-wide. Everything that you buy on this site is going to be 50% off. Again, they got the best pillows, sheets, mattresses. They got the mattress protector. If you're sloppy and spill things and you don't want to jack up your mattress, they have pretty much everything you need. They've got weighted blankets now. They've got the adjustable base, which we really like. I've got one in my home. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Use the code drinkitbros for 50% off site-wide. And don't forget about their pay-as-you-go plan. If you're with approved credit, you're going to be able to pay this thing off over the course of 3 to 5 years for $25 to $35 a month. It's nothing. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros today and use the code drinkitbros for 50% off. This episode is also brought to you by BlackRifleCoffee.com, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth literally was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits from being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there. And the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for you. You can do just the plain coffee club. And if you want your two bags of espresso or your two bags of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those two bags or one bag or whatever you want every month, or rather, you can use the ECS, the exclusive coffee club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like. You know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something, do whatever you want. Use the code CITIZEN, you're going to get those points off. This episode is brought to you by firstform.com/citizen. Free shipping on all orders over $75 when you use the link. And you're not going to spend less than $75. I mean, they got the best products in the world, especially the OptiGreens. You know me, I don't eat vegetables because they're fucking pointless. So I supplement with OptiGreens 50 from First Form. It is precisely formulated green superfood powder meant for overall immune system support and digestive health. It's really good, aside from just getting the daily greens into your body that you need. And make sure, by the way, you're taking this with MCT, because you have to take anything like this with MCT. 80% of your immune system is located in your gut and your digestive tract, right? So healthy digestion is essential for overall health and wellness, not to mention that most of your serotonin, I think 96% of your serotonin or 94%, is made in your gut as well. So you're going to be in a better mood. You're going to feel better physically, and you're going to feel better mentally if you are taking these greens. OptiGreen 50 has 50 chosen ingredients, effectively dosed. It's not necessarily how many ingredients there are, though, but it's about the right amount of each. Taste and texture, not like no other product in the market. It's not gritty. It doesn't have a weird flavor. It's got sweet berry flavors, actually. 100% of the greens are all grown and manufactured inside the United States, and they are bioavailable. Now, they've got other products as well. They've got the Microfactor, which you see behind me on every show, and I take them every day. You know, you got essential fatty acids, CoQ10, you got all the stuff you need in one little packet for your daily vitamin pack. And you mix that, you make yourself OptiGreens 50 shake, and you take those pills with it, and you're going to improve your life precipitously. You're going to feel better, you're going to look better, so on and so forth. So go to firstform.com, that's 1STPHORM.com/citizen. Use the code. You're going to get free shipping on all orders over $50.
Yeah, actually, we were there on a different island. I think it was on Holo. I might be wrong about that. On a different island, an SF guy, we got killed on a ID down there. Barely, you know, you don't hear about that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of the forgotten part of the GWAT. I've always been interested in it because I've had plenty of buddies from First Group and from Ground Branch who have been down there operating and shit. And they've got, I mean, it's wild stories that seem like they would be pretty fun for TV and film. You know what I mean? It just never kind of materialized.
You're kind of off the radar. You know, you're even though there is a flagpole, there is a kind of like a headquarters area. If you're even there, I mean, you take a step outside, you don't feel like you're close to the flagpole. You have a little more freedom, I think, of maneuver down there, particularly if you have a good relationship with your Filipino counterpart, which I did. So it's an interesting part of the world, that's for sure. And when the light's not on you, you can do a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. It's always nice not to have cameras following you around when you're trying to do shit. So let's talk
senior
about
level leadership over your shoulder and directives coming down because something happened at the Chow Hall, you know, in Baghdad, whatever it is. Like there just wasn't that. And and also at the time, comms were sketchy. I mean, it's for whatever reason, it was very nice to have comms go down on these islands from time to time. It gives you a little breathing room.
Yeah, it is nice. Certainly. And I want to talk some about the show here. So Citizen is the reason I named it that is because the premise of the show is that you can bitch and moan about your rights and how things are going in the world. And you know, you can wait around for somebody else to secure those rights for you and you will be a subject under their rule. As Plato said, and you know, if you refuse to take part in your own governance, you're doomed to be ruled by fools, right? Or you can, you know, secure your rights yourself by performing the responsibilities required of you. And that's the literal definition of a citizen in Merriam-Webster. It's somebody who had with the rights and responsibilities given to them for being a citizen. And, you know, it's all about personal responsibility and not just for its own sake, not to moralize personal responsibility or anything like that, but because it's fucking effective. You know what I mean? I use this quote a lot, but G.K. Chesterton used to say that men didn't love Rome because she was great. Rome was great because the men loved her. And that's the responsibility of every American. If you're going to wear that fucking flag on your shoulder and talk about how patriotic you are, you better goddamn be ready to contribute, right? And pull your weight. Otherwise, you're full of shit, right? It's just that seems like really basic to me. Like we should all kind of be on that same page, you know, and it's like anytime you let some external entity, whether it's government or something else, interfere in the day-to-day activities in your community, there's a price to pay for that. You might be getting something from them, but they're getting some from you too, right? It never comes for free. And I think we should be deeply suspicious of anybody who shows up with, you know, with gifts, right? It's almost always a Trojan.
Where are those bearing gifts?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, there's absolutely, I mean, the very least people need to inform themselves and vote and realize that tweets, headlines are there to manipulate behaviors and thoughts. And they're all the more powerful in this age of social media and getting powerful, more powerful each and every day. So at the very least, as citizens, voting, informing yourself to be an informed citizen when you walk into that, to cast that ballot, and raising good citizens, raising children to be good citizens. I think those three things are probably top of list off the top of my head as things that anyone can and should do as a responsible citizen of this nation. Otherwise, you have this gift and you're throwing it away for future generations. It's not really about us at this point. It's about our kids and our grandkids. It's about those future generations. The decisions we make today, the vote that we cast today is about our kids and our grandkids. It's not really about us at all. And people from the inception of this country up until today have sacrificed everything to give us these rights, to secure these rights for us. So it's our responsibility as citizens then to do the same for the next generation. And it seems like that is getting more and more difficult as the government continues to encroach upon these rights. We continue to give up rights almost without a second thought in some cases, and to have our thoughts and behaviors manipulated by entities that benefit
from us being divided and from that manipulation, meaning social media companies and what else? Well, politicians. Those two entities definitely benefit from our division. One to consolidate bases and the other to get more data and become more profitable and therefore more powerful and therefore can unleash even more lobbyists upon Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But something when we talk about citizens, something that really pandemic highlighted was how important local level politics are. We're focused on national level politics a lot of the time because that's what's on cable news. That's what the headlines really focus on. But I think when we look at these school boards and we look at local level politics, COVID, if it did anything, it highlighted the importance of getting involved at the local level. The hard part about that is that a lot of those that are out there working and building businesses are doing just that. They're doing that. They're all in on building businesses. And then next probably comes family, and school board stuff and local level politics falls somewhere down the chain. And I think a lot of us are guilty of that, me included. But if we recognize it, then we can take steps to combat that. But you know, what you said, the point of your show in the preface here to my first book is how I finished it, finished this preface up. And it's kind of what I do before the book kicks off. And I do it with all of the books that kind of sets the tone for what people are about to read. But my last sentence in this, all right, the fundamental value of freedom is what sets us apart from the rest of the world. We are citizens, not subjects, and we must stay ever vigilant that we remain so. Mm. I wrote that on August 6th, 2017 in there. And what's actually been really interesting about this publishing journey, and I didn't know how it was gonna be at the outset, is that there's been zero pressure from Simon & Schuster in New York to change anything in my novels. There's never been even a hint of, hey, do you mind lightening up on the freedom stuff or on the gun stuff? Like zero. I have 100% complete creative control and freedom with the novels. And I didn't know if that was going to be an issue going into publishing because I had no background in it at all. But to have complete creative control over something and have no outside entities that are kind of, let's say, above you in the chain of command, right, because they're publishing your book, try to influence what you write is refreshing and actually gives me some hope.
Yeah, I like what you said about, well, one, I like that you introduced, because in some of the other books, like the one where you're talking about, quantum computing, you talk about some of the dangers of that, what might happen and things like that. So it's always the preface. Prefaces are used in a lot of different ways in novels like that, but I really enjoy the way you use yours. Back to what you were saying about, I guess the least you can do in as a citizen to be informed, you know what I mean? And then, you know, take some pretty basic steps, especially at the local level. We talk a lot about our failed and untrustworthy institutions and then about propaganda. I mean, we're seeing a lot of it right now from over the last 18 months, especially, it's been fucking wild. And now there's more of it coming. The only way you can really insulate yourself from any of that stuff is to be informed and prepared. Right. I mean, you only have to be a little bit more informed than the propaganda itself to be like, nope, that's bullshit. You know what I mean? It's not that much effort, to be honest, to do that stuff. And you can remain politely skeptical about things as well. There's no, like, maybe there's some price to pay for that because people are trying to, you know, coerce or force you into a certain position or to even take a position where you're not ready to. But, you know, polite skepticism is always a very useful tool in your tool belt. And then, you know, the next thing you got into about how this is all for the next generation, every step you take in your life, you're cutting a path, right? And the path is going to be taken by the people that follow after you as well, not just your kids and your family, but other people. And that's kind of the way I want to get your thoughts on this, because it's kind of the way life used to be. A man would turn 18, figure out a career, find a wife, have some kids. And then the purpose of your life became to, you know, provide and protect. But downstream, it became, I'm going to give my kids a better life than what I had. Right now, we had pretty good lives, mine and your generation. We had pretty good lives. And I don't know that we knew what it meant to give our kids a better life than what we had. You know what I mean? like we, a lot of us were latchkeys, so maybe more time at home would have been the answer, right? More time actually spent with your family.
Maybe. But, I think about that a lot.
Yeah, it's like, but I, for a lot of people, I don't know that I could give my, when I have kids, I don't know if I'm going to be able to give them a better life than what I had. Cause mine, I mean, my younger years are pretty rough, but my adult years have been pretty fucking dope. You know what I mean? It's been great. So I'm not sure we spent the requisite amount of time fleshing out what it means to give people a better life, because better doesn't mean more. I think correct. We made that mistake. I think we made the mistake of thinking better means more. And now we're in a fucking particular bind because of it.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think better might just mean opportunity, but not just opportunity. I think it means also appreciating that opportunity and realizing what was sacrificed so that you can have that opportunity or those opportunities. And you said something interesting about staying skeptical, polite skepticism. And yeah, I think there's a difference between being skeptical and cynical. So a little bit of skepticism, very healthy, I think. So there's a difference between those two things. So remaining semi-skeptical, politely skeptical will serve you well, I believe. But also going back in the pages of history. So in order to give current events context, it's not just about studying and being informed on what's happening now. I think it's about going back into the pages of history so that you have a foundation from which to understand the present. And I think that gets lost a lot, especially now with so many distractions out there, so many competing distractions out there. We're seeing it with our kids. I note it myself, being involved on social media to engage with people and thank them for following along, listening to the podcast, watching the show on TV, reading the books. There are just so many distractions out there that keep you from opening that book on history, which will give you a better foundation from which to make decisions going forward and understanding the current climate, a current issue. But really going back into those pages on a certain issue is the first step, because that's really where you can establish an understanding of why. And in this case, why we have the freedoms that we do, how fortunate we are that we have these freedoms, even though they're being encroached upon, and even though they might not be what they were 50 years ago, we still have them, and we can still fight for them. But understanding where they came from and why we have them, and also understanding that these things are natural rights. If you got dropped here out of nowhere and had no context about where you were, what you were doing, and you're attacked by, let's say, 8 people, you know enough to defend that gift of life. That means that's a natural thing, and that's within each and every one of us. It may be suppressed in a lot of people, particularly in New York and Los Angeles. Well, come on, that wasn't very nice, it's true. It might be suppressed in a lot of us because of a lot of outside influences, perhaps, but it's still there. And protecting that gift of life, which naturally then translates on as a citizen and as a husband and father, protecting your spouse and your children, that's a very natural thing. And we're very lucky to have that enshrined in founding documents that still need to be fought for.
Yeah. I don't know if you've certainly, you know, history is, man, we just don't know it anymore. And it's so important to, there's an author, Tim Wu, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he wrote this book called The Attention Mergence. And he details how, the early political campaigns in the late 19th and early 20th century that used media, print media, and then the radio later on, all the strategy that they used for their marketing, for their campaign marketing, was taken from middle and late 19th century snake oil salesmen. They used the same kind of, like, they focused on buzzwords and things like that. They focused on giving people nicknames, like your opponent nicknames, that are kind of negative, just to reinforce constantly that negativity in their head associated with that guy. He does a really good job of laying out how the pathway from the snake oil salesman, and then early 20th century politicians used it in their campaign marketing. And then later in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Mad Men, Madison Avenue, used it for, it became modern American advertising, right? So this stuff, we like to think of propaganda and fake news and blah, 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 all that shit. Like it's some kind of new thing. It's like, no, this shit's always been going on. It's just a matter of what kind of modality is being used to communicate the fucking bullshit. But propaganda is not new. It's a really interesting book. And then he wrote a follow-up book. What's it called again? It's called The Attention Merchants. And then he wrote a, he wrote a follow-up book. Hold on, let me see. Let me get the name right. Make sure I don't fuck it up.
I'm ordering that as soon as we're off the podcast.
Yeah, it's and, really good. It's really good. You'll probably.
I can't say that I'm shocked.
No.
Definitely not shocked.
No, I'm sorry. Let's see. Where is it? Oh no, I'm sorry. That was the follow-up book. The first book that he wrote on this was called The Master Switch, and it's how information tech over the years, whether it be writing and distribution, or then the printing press, and then radio, then TV, and so on, then the internet, has always been weaponized by governments, basically. Yeah. Like anything that's made for any kind of communicative modality, they just snatch it up and try to weaponize it immediately. So a couple of really good books. The Attention Merchants especially, though, is it's like if you read that book, you can see exactly how people are being programmed now to think a certain way. And that's why, you know, to your point from before, we may be more susceptible to propaganda now than ever, which is interesting, right? Because we've got more information now as well. Mm-hmm. You as a human being have the ability to inform yourself better than you ever have before. And yet we're still more susceptible now to propaganda than we ever have been.
Yeah, these platforms are tools just like a hammer, just like anything else. You can you can use it for good, for evil, for different purposes, nefarious and otherwise. There's a lot of good to it as well. But like what we're doing right now, obviously wouldn't be able to do it without these platforms.
Yeah.
But going back to what you said earlier about being a latchkey kid, like I look back on that fondly. I was a latchkey kid as well. Coming home, actually, you know, finding where that key was. I have a great memory of where it was on a nail and reaching behind and grabbing it, letting myself in all alone at age 7, 6, maybe for sure. 7, 8, 9, 10. And guess what? There wasn't this device that I had that was trying to manipulate me. I had whatever magazines my parents had lying around, whatever books my parents had there at the house. I had very fortunate to have a house and a backyard where I could climb trees and put up ropes and a little tree fort that I could do pull-ups on as I got older. And not even that old, watching Rocky very early in life, started those pull-ups very early on. So I have very fond memories of that. But there wasn't much that was manipulating you from the outside.
Right.
And that's obviously very different today. So it's a tough thing. My wife and I talk about it all the time. And as it pertains to our kids, particularly our youngest, our oldest just skirted it. She's 18. And so she just kind of missed, like it was there, but for some reason she was on the outside of that bubble. Like she had some things, she was aware of it, but she was also aware of what it was trying to do. Man, our 13-year-old, he is in it. He is in it. It's a tough thing as a parent to try to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, how do you handle that? Because it's kind of a fucking tornado, to be honest. Like it's like you don't want them to be a Luddite. You know, I want my kids to be able to understand tech and be able to leverage it, you know, to do good things in the world and better themselves. But it seems like around every corner, you know what I mean? It's around every corner is a windowless van with free candy written on the side of it. And they're serving up either some kind of abuse or some kind of stupid ideology. You know what I mean? Like how do you police that? I don't know if you even can.
Yeah. When we have the technical means to control it and watch what's going on and that sort of thing, set time limits and all that sort of a thing. But that's the way they communicate with friends. So it's extremely difficult, but we put in place what we can. We try to talk about it. Of course, he's sick of hearing it. But the day changers just to make him aware of what's going on, make aware that anything that he does or any outside influence is manipulating, and just to be aware of that going in. But if it's not the phone, guess what? On that Xbox or whatever else is on, that's it connected and there's influences coming through that. It's extremely difficult. So just like any parent, I think we're just trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, I like the one phrase from The Coddling of the American Mind that I really appreciated was, don't prepare the road for your children, prepare your children for the road. Like you can't
Nice.
You can't you can't change the environment. You know what I mean? I mean, to some degree you can, but as much as we missed out on some human to human contact during that latchkey process, I think the independence that we generated from it was probably worth it, to be honest. I mean, I feel like the kids I hear about these days, the ones that, the ones that you hear about, I guess, are just, they seem hopeless. You know what I mean? They just have no life skills at all. You know, it's very troubling to me. It's like, what? That is one of our primary jobs is, like, maybe jobs 1A and 1B are to create a good sustainable world, you know, for ourselves in the future, and then prepare our children for the future. Those seem to be two of the more important things going on. It seems like we don't prioritize those things at all anymore.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I remember coming home and I had a pellet gun. And so I'd set up an obstacle course and I had the pellet gun, but first I'd run sprints on the hill, come down, shoot that gun, drop it, run to a rope hanging off a tree, climb that a couple times, drop down, climb up onto the roof, send a few arrows down into a hay bale. And so it run to the chimney. I put a rope around the chimney and set up a rappel thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's some rappelling off our, going around. Like if I'd gone down, no one was going to be there till that was, let's say, at 3 o'clock. No one was going to be there till like 6:30.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just by a heap at the bottom of the chimney on the outside of the house. So, but that was interesting. I mean, there was risk involved and you had to be creative and you're trying to better yourself. So it was, and it was preparing for the future. So I, and when I got tired of that, guess what was inside? A book. I really look back fondly on those times that I was left alone to my own devices to figure things out.
Yeah. I had something similar in my backyard. So we had a rope, thick climbing rope tied from between two trees that we would, skirt along. And then we had a climbing rope hanging out of a treehouse we built. Now looking back on it, I was like, man, that's like 30, 40 feet up there. And when I think about it now, I'm like, that's like 15 feet maybe. Right. It's not that tall, but those were good times just playing army in the backyard.
Exactly. And the imagination side of it. There's a lot to, especially, there's a lot to learning how to entertain yourself in a productive way, but also just having time to daydream. And I think there's a lot, especially as a writer, being able to quietly daydream and think things through and think up scenarios and think how you'd solve problems, just made up problems, I think is valuable. And you had to do that because there wasn't this constant input of from the outside. There wasn't constant entertainment. And that's lost a lot today, unless you force it on your kid. In which case they're probably just jonesing for that phone again. They're just thinking about getting it back. But having to solve problems like that creatively, aggressively sometimes, that are just made up in your head, I think is extremely valuable, particularly probably in life, but especially as a writer. If you have constant input from the outside, you're not doing that.
Right.
As a kid days. So it's tough, but I try to stay hopeful. Somebody was telling me not too long, last year, let's say 8 months ago, he said, you have to stay positive because otherwise you can't manifest that future for your kids, for the next generation. So I thought a lot about that since he told me that. It was on a podcast actually.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's interesting. So staying positive to manifest that future for your kids, is something he passed on. And I thought was valuable.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you can, again, back to the point of the show, you can bitch and moan about how things are, you can do something, you know what I mean? I think, yeah, there's good data now to show that, our memories and our level of creativity are getting worse because we're not using them anymore. Not just how our memory, like we're selectively breeding our own brains at this point. You know what I mean? We're selectively breeding neurons to expect immediate satisfaction of whatever it can, right? So we're weaning ourselves off serotonin and onto dopamine, which is not the best, right? I mean, it's like, it's the cheap thrill versus the lasting happiness. You know what I mean? We're sacrificing that. And there's no wonder, like there's a lot of reasons, including hormone levels that have been fucked with and stuff and a general malaise to explain a lot of the suicide numbers that are going on. And I don't mean veteran. I just mean in the general population, it's up as well. Even for teenage girls, which used to be one of the more resilient against suicide, right? All of these things are on the rise right now. And it's no wonder, right? Because we're changing the relationship between effort and outcome, I guess. You know what I mean? It's like the expectation that things will be good regardless, and then things are not good. It reminds me of that. It reminds me of that veteran whose life is more or less going pretty well, and they can't figure out why they're fucking depressed and want to kill themselves all the time. The two don't match up. If things suck and you feel bad about it, that makes sense to your brain. If things are going pretty well and you fucking hate your life, then, you know, it's like, what do you do then? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, damn, everything's good and I still feel like this. There's no hope anymore. You know what I mean? And we're creating a fucking hopeless society at this point.
Oh, I thought we were going to stay positive. Yeah, I know that.
Well, I mean, you have to identify the problem before we can treat it, right?
Yep. No, exactly right.
So there's something exactly about like putting that device down and you know what? I'm going to read the book this time, or I'm going to listen to it on Audible instead of going to watch the movie or whatever the fuck, right? Not that people shouldn't watch your TV show. They should. yeah, it's like take the stairs. That's a motto of mine. It's like, you know, sometimes it's not convenient, whatever, you know, and it's not like I'm not trying to moralize the issue or anything. All I'm trying to do is remind people that human beings have done things a particular way for the last, I don't know, 250,000 years, give or take. And you're not going to outsmart nature. You know what I mean? If you try to rapidly change things like that, there's going to be a price to pay for it. So it is, it is within your power to look at the easy way and look at the difficult way and take the difficult way. That is a choice that you personally are in control of. That's the beauty of this, is that nobody can fucking stop you. You just, all you have to do is be disciplined and make that decision, and your life will improve markedly. Not only your life, but the lives around you as well, because nothing teaches more than setting a good example.
You know, thinking about those distractions, I remember reading an article back in the mid-80s, and it was probably in Time or Newsweek, because that's what those are the news magazines that came to our house. But it was when Miami Vice came out, and I distinctly remember this, just being even then just a fan of popular culture, all those shows in the 80s and movies and everything else. And the article pointed out that if you looked at Miami Vice and then you looked back at, say, Gunsmoke or something like that, the camera and how long the camera was on a certain actor, a certain scene, was so different. And they were worried about the attention, particularly of the youth watching Miami Vice and having not being able to pay attention for much longer anymore because of those camera takes that were so different from 20, 30 years prior. So it's similar, different, obviously. It seemed alarmist back then. And of course, we think that right now that it's a lot worse, which I can't see how you can say that it's not as far as attention grabbing platforms and devices and all the rest of it. But that was a worry back then. It's still a worry today. Of course, there's a lot more of it.
We had a discussion about, there was an article about this recently, actually. I don't know where it was now, but we talked about it on the show maybe a month ago on Drinker Bros. We were talking about it, but because Ross was a director for a long time, is like the establishing shot was quite a bit longer, or the end of a scene. Like if you look at, you know, film and television from the 1950s, for example, there would be the end of the scene, the dialogue would be complete, and then there would be like a 15-second lead out from that. You know what I mean? With some music or something, just to like give. Well, I don't know what the purpose was, but what the purpose seemed like was to give me a chance to, I don't know, absorb everything that just happened. You know what I mean? And process, now it's just like cut, right? As quickly as possible. They don't want to lose your attention. It's you know, but you know, maybe it's a chicken or egg thing. Maybe our attention's getting shorter, so they have to do that, or maybe it feeds each other. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's interesting though, no doubt about it.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I like looking at stuff like that. Just because even if it is a negative change, it's still within the parameters of workability. You know what I mean? Like you can still adjust for things. That's why I like Like it sounds like doom and gloom a lot when you're talking about stuff like this, but really it's just information.
Yeah.
Like, oh, how am I going to adjust now? Like, hey, it's a shitty day out and you got to take a sniper shot. It's like, all right, well, I just got to plug that dope in. That's just the way it is, man. There's no change of reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hold left. Yeah. Going back to something you were talking about earlier about a citizen, the responsibility of citizens, most of history, you had to prove yourself to your tribe and to your society in order to gain membership and be accepted by that tribe and by that society, meaning that you had to go through usually a series of tests, which I think is still, you know, I think it's a very natural thing, which is why so many people are drawn to Marine Corps boot camp or any boot camp really, or now that people know about BUDS or Q course or whatever it is, there's still this draw in our DNA to test ourselves and prove ourselves. It just happened to be mandatory for most of human history. You had to prove your value to that tribe, because back then it wasn't just about a quote unquote good life or a bad life or whatever else. No, it was about survival of your lineage, survival of that tribe, survival of that society. So you had to prove yourself, and that was just a part of it. So we've lost that today. I think it's still in there in a lot of us, and it's just even whether you recognize it or not. And you can see it in the hero's journey, in movies, television shows, and books. There's this draw to something that's primal. There's a draw to a campfire, just like there's a draw to telling a story around a campfire. Why is that? Because you're passing on lessons from the hunt and from battle to future generations so that they don't have to relearn those same lessons in blood. They can make that a part of their experience and they can adapt going forward. So that's still in us. It's just been tamped down, I'd say, over the millennia.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have the physiological part. We've got the psychological part is still going on, but the physiological part, that is to say the practical exercise of it, seems to be gone now. We don't have rites of passage that are intrinsic to society in the West anymore, except for, I guess, Jews do, right, with the bar mitzvah. That's when you know you're, but how does like an Irish kid in the suburbs know that they've become an adult? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's different because it used to be like, you know, at 12 or whatever, you would go hunt, kill something with your dad and take a bite out of the heart. And it's like, all right, I'm a man now or whatever. You know, is it just getting your fucking driver's license now? Because that seems like a pretty low bar. And, you know, that's why custom and culture matters. It isn't about excluding people. You know what I mean? It's about taking what's good about what you've learned so far, like you're saying, and making that into an organized thought process. You know what I mean? Like, okay, we know that these things are important for people to feel a sense of belonging. And then it also has the added benefit of, you know, promoting our society and progressing it farther down the road. It's like, all right, cool. We know all these things and we're just going to give up on them, I guess now. Right. Because I don't know why, like, it seems like they've all disappeared, but I can't put my finger on why we would have done that. Like, why get rid of those rites of passage? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, or we get distracted elsewhere. Society moves in a different direction. There's so many factors, but it comes back to taking these lessons and applying them going forward as wisdom, whether we're doing that personally with our families or at the national strategic type of a level. We're not that good at it. We used to have to be good at it. Now you don't have to be that good at it, because what happens? Look at what happened in Afghanistan. Look at what happened in Iraq. Guess what? Here in the United States, we keep moving forward. We're still moving forward. It impacted a generation, yes, of those who went downrange and their families. But the greater populace, not so much. They watched it on news and they then moved on. They watched the disastrous withdrawal on television, were outraged for a little bit, and then we got distracted by another news cycle. We got manipulated into watching other things, being concerned about other things. So will we take those lessons from Afghanistan, let's say, in particular, and apply those lessons going forward as wisdom? I don't know. I don't know. We've proven not to be very good at that.
Yeah. We've also done what I think is some pretty remarkable and difficult to repair damage to our institutions and the trust in them. I mean,
you have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand. And even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're in what the DoD is calling a recruiting crisis. I don't think it's a recruiting crisis. I think it's a crisis of conscience. People, like it's, you know, it's doing war is a difficult thing. You know what I mean? No matter how, you know, selfless and patriotic you are, it is still a difficult thing, not just for you, but for your entire family. And there's a fucking price to pay for that shit, a big price to pay for it. And, you know, at the end of the day, it is the validation of our honor and sacrifice that I think that keeps most people going. People don't join the infantry or you know, SOF because of a college tuition or bonuses. You know what I mean? That would be an insane reason to do any of those things, to be honest. It is, you know, it's as you said before, it's like, I think a big part of it is proving yourself to society, but you have to feel like society is worth proving yourself to do that. You know what I mean? And I wonder from your perspective, I mean, you lifelong service, you continue to serve now and through charitable ways and through, you know, being a good representation of what a fucking warrior is. I think those are all really important. But what do you tell your kids? What would you tell your kid if she's 18 now, she wants to go join the military? What do you say? Because I frankly would never let my kid join the military right now.
Yeah, it's tough. And for her in particular, of all our kids, she'd be the one that would be on that path. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was because of, you know, she grew up around. I mean, she's learning jujitsu from SEALs and from top class jujitsu players, and she's going to out to the desert to shoot with Navy SEAL snipers at age 7, 8, 9, 10. So she was around all that growing up. But even so, I don't think that really, because it was so natural, I don't think it really cemented, hey, this is something I need to do. It was just something that was, and there's other opportunities out there. But we went to Pearl Harbor, and we went there for the anniversary commemoration events, and we took veterans over there with the Best Defense Foundation. So she's sitting at tables with these guys who are 96, 97, 98, 99, 100, 101 years old, hearing stories about them in World War II. And that's different than me telling her about her grandfather, right, or about her watching a movie or reading a book. She's hearing it from this person who tells her how he walked out. He's passed away since, and this is only 2 years, two and a half years ago. He walks out onto the runway, Ford Island. He watches these planes bank over these mountains, drop down, and strafe the runway. And those are the first shots at Pearl Harbor. And he dives into what was then a sewage ditch, shows us that ditch. It's just dry now. Says he gets up, he walks us, he shows us because they left the marks in the tarmac and in the hangars from the bullets back then. Walks, says he got up, ran to the edge of the shore and looks down at Battleship Row, watches these planes bank these and drop down and drop the first torpedoes in Pearl Harbor. And he was a mechanic then, went on to become a pilot. He sunk a Japanese submarine in the Pacific, helped sink a Japanese aircraft carrier, and then went to the Med and sunk a Nazi submarine. So she's hearing all that from him. And that's just one. But then we went to Normandy, and she's on the beach at Normandy with a guy who's first out of his landing craft, and hearing the story about, he's sitting in a Jeep on the beach. She's standing next to him. I'm taking pictures, trying not to interrupt. Mm. And he's telling her the story of him running across the beach at Normandy. So I think those things would inspire her to join the military because of the story she just got to hear from that generation.
Yeah.
So if anything, I think it's that for her. But what I encourage, I don't think I would encourage or discourage. It's a path. I'll inform best I can. I'll support the best I can, but the decisions will obviously be the kids.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it kind of, the relationship between the warrior and the risk involved, I always think of the old Spartan phrase, Kalos Thanatos, which means a beautiful death, right? Like if you're in an impossible combat situation, you're looking for, you know, a heroic confrontation worthy of the crown of life, I think is the phrase they used to use, something like that. It's like, and it also reminds me of something my second commander in the 82nd used to say, because we would go out on operations and stuff, and you know, we're all knuckleheads throwing rocks at each other like idiots. It's like, oh, we should name this operation fucking Dum Dum or whatever. It's like, you should never name an operation anything that you wouldn't want to show up on your fucking epitaph. You know what I mean? Like, don't be disrespectful to people who might fucking lose their lives in this. And that always stuck with me. And I think it drove home the point that I already kind of knew internally, but I never really articulated to myself, that a big part of all of this is that the person doing the sacrifice has to know that the sacrifice is worthy, right? That it's noble. And we just don't have that feeling anymore. We've been lied to too often, and our patriotism and our selflessness has been leveraged against us too often. And I don't, you know, in a confrontation like this, somebody's got to be the diplomat. Somebody has to make the move to be the bigger person. And I, frankly, as much as I want to hate and distrust all the institutions, part of me thinks that, you know, it's going to be on people like us who have that service mentality to repair this stuff. And certainly we're not going to wait around for the government to fix anything, because they never do.
Yeah. They don't have the greatest track record there. And speaking of track records, let's say you're a father, and you have a son or daughter who wants to join the military. They're a senior in high school, and you just watched the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And you're thinking, and you have no military experience, let's say you've never read a book on strategy or tactics, you don't even have to watch the military film, no touch points with the military, but you can apply common sense to that and what you saw and ask that question. Is this the best that the United States military could do with 20 years to prepare for it? And this is the best they could do. And I'm watching this right now. Maybe I'm not going to encourage my son or daughter to join the military if they're going to serve under people whose best efforts just played out in real time, and they had 20 years not just to prepare but of lessons that they could apply towards this situation, and this is the best that they could do. And then you look and find, oh wait a sec, there's been no accountability. So those same people are going to be in charge, or the people behind them are going to look up and see that there was no accountability and continue along the same paths, meaning not speaking truth to power because of what it's going to do to your quote unquote career. No one took the stars off their shoulders, dropped them on a desk and walked out. Yeah. And they had I heard someone asked about that, and they said, well, they could do more being in there. Like, it would have been worse with it. Yeah. Okay. And now they're probably serving on the board of, you know, whatever company, defense company X in there, whatever it might be. So yeah, if you're applying common sense to these things as a citizen, and you know the importance of military service, you know the importance of testing yourselves, but you saw that happen, are you going to encourage your son or daughter into that institution? Don't think so.
It seems unlikely. Yeah. Luckily, there's a lot of ways to serve, and it isn't always the military. I mean, you can, what I recommend to people because a lot of people ask me about this because they have kids or they are young people, 17, 18, 19 years old. They want to serve their country somehow. I'm like, I personally wouldn't join, but you know, if you want to do it, make smart decisions, but you can go become a sheriff as well. A sheriff's deputy. That's your boss is an elected person. You know what I mean? And sheriffs in America are one of the last lines of defense against tyranny, in my opinion. There's EMTs. There's all kinds of ways to serve a country. It doesn't just have to be the military. Now, before we get out of here, you've got some more work coming. I know there's strikes going on for the production side of stuff, but You're getting back to writing and whatnot, and then you've got a couple of books you're working on as well. You want to tell me about those?
Yep, working on James Reese 7 that comes out this May, and then my first nonfiction work that I'm working on with amazing guy. He's a Pulitzer Prize finalist, military historian, James Scott. He has five books out there, most on World War II, and we're doing a book on the 1983 Beirut Barracks bombing, 40th anniversary of which is coming up here on October 23rd. So the book will be out next fall, but there's a lot of declassified documents from the Reagan administration that allow you to go in, do the research, and find out what was going on behind the scenes that led up to that attack, who was advocating to put Marines ashore, who's advocating to keep them on ships in the Med. Of course, the embassy bombing in April of 83, which then led into to October. Yeah. And really the opening shots of what we'd later come to call the War on Terror. So so that's in there. And then the scripts for the Ben Edwards origin story starring Taylor Kitsch. And those are good. Like, we got five of them in before the strike, the writer strike. Now that the writer strike's over, we're back on those. They are solid scripts. I'm super fired up about that. And then that'll roll right into True Believer, which is the second book starring Chris Pratt. And then we'll just keep going from there. So it's super fun. Like I said, I'm a student. I'm really enjoying the screenwriting process. It's much more collaborative, obviously. But it's interesting learning something new every day. So a lot on the plate, and I thoroughly enjoy all of it though.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad everybody's getting back to work a little bit now, and I'm really curious. I'm looking forward to this book on Beirut. I mean, I'm not sure that the average American, even after all the dust up when we clipped him a couple of years ago, know about how much of a role Soleimani played in a lot of the shit that happened to the United States over the last like 40 years or so. Right. So good. Oh, yeah, good thing he's fucking dead.
It's super interesting. Especially those early days when we didn't really, guys coming out of Vietnam. So people had Vietnam experience. They had counterinsurgency experience in Vietnam. A lot of those guys rolled into government agencies in the 80s and are now dealing with this new threat that really first appeared in Europe and the Middle East and then came to our shores. But it's very interesting to go back and look at those origins and try to extrapolate some of those lessons and which ones that we did apply and which ones that we didn't. So what my goal is to keep those lessons alive for future generations, for people who don't know about that event, or people who've forgotten about it or seem to remember it on a headline somewhere when they were younger, but don't really understand what it meant, who was involved, and how that plays into what's going on in the Middle East today. So there's lessons there that I want to keep alive. Once again, responsibility of a citizen, keep those lessons alive for future generations. So that's really the goal of the Beirut book.
Good, man. Well, I appreciate you doing it, and appreciate you coming today. Everybody go check out Jack Carr. Check out all the books. Is this six or seven? This is seven for Reese, right?
Seven's coming up. And yep, seven this May.
And he's a full-blown Ground Branch guy at this point in his life, which is nice, right? He's back on the good side,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, we got some he's on the edge. He's on the edge. Well, they keep trying to pull him in, and he keeps going away. So this one is really about – each of my books has a theme, and I start with a theme. But it keeps me on track. Start with a title so I'm not wasting bandwidth trying to think about a title. I do a one-page executive summary that I read and ask myself, is this worth the next year and a half of my life? And if someone were to read this on the back of a book as they walk to the airport, is this worth time that they're never going to get back? And if the answer is both those is yes, then I dive right in. So this seventh book really explores loyalty and then the future of AI, a fight over AI supremacy, what that looks like.
Well, I can't wait, man. I've read them all already. I make a habit to whenever a new book in a series that I really like. So The Nowhere Man by Hurwitz is one of my favorite series as well. And every time
he's
new
great.
One, yeah, I love that dude. Every time a new one comes out, he's a big fan of yours, obviously, as well. Every time a new one comes out, I go back and listen to all of the books and then the new one when it comes out, because he always sends me the audio version early. And I do the same for yours. Every time a new one of yours comes out, I do the same thing. So it's really great. I'm looking forward to it. But look, thanks for coming today, man. I appreciate your insight and all the work you do.
Oh, man, no, thank you for doing what you do. You guys are out there essentially on the front lines of this culture war. So you're doing it. It means a lot to all of us. So sincerely appreciate it.
Thanks.
Brother.
I appreciate that. And everybody go check out Danger Close. A lot of great interviews over there as well. Check out Jack Carr and all of his stuff. Thank you all for listening. This has been Cities.
We
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.